Chapter 58. Not yet. Not till we have had a gallop over the downs. I am so thirsty for that, I can think of nothing else. I wish the hunting had begun. Sunday the 20th, 27th, Monday, Tuesday. Gwendolyn was counting on her fingers with the prettiest nod, while she looked at Grand Court, and at last swept one palm over the other while she said triumphantly, "It will begin in 10 days." "Let us be married in 10 days, then," said Grand Court, "and we shall not be bored about the stables." "What do women always say in answer to that?" said Gwendolyn, mischievously. "They agree to it," said the lover, rather off his guard. "Then I will not," said Gwendolyn, taking up her gauntlets and putting them on, while she kept her eyes on him with gathering fun in them. The scene was pleasant on both sides. A cruder lover would have lost the view of her pretty ways and attitudes, and spoiled all by stupid attempts at caresses, utterly destructive of drama. Grandcourt preferred the drama, and Gwendolyn, left at ease, found her spirits rising continually as she played at reigning. Perhaps if Klesmer had seen more of her in this unconscious kind of acting, instead of when she was trying to be theatrical, he might have rated her chance higher. When they had had a glorious gallop, however, she was in a state of exhilaration that disposed her to think well of hastening the marriage which would make her life all of a piece with this splendid kind of enjoyment. She would not debate any more about an act to which as he had committed herself, and she consented to fix the wedding on that day 3 weeks, notwithstanding the difficulty of fulfilling the customary laws of the trousseau. Lush, of course, was made aware of the engagement by abundant signs, without being formally told. But he expected some communication as a consequence of it, and after a few days he became rather impatient under Grandcourt's silence, feeling sure that the change would affect his personal prospects, and wishing to know exactly how. His tactics no longer included any opposition which he did not love for its own sake. He might easily cause Grandcourt a great deal of annoyance, but it would be to his own injury, and to create annoyance was not a motive with him. Miss Gwendolyn he would certainly not have been sorry to frustrate a little, but after all there was no knowing what would come. It was nothing new that Grandcourt should show a perverse willfulness. Yet in his freak about this girl he struck Lush rather newly as something like a man who was led on by an ominous fatality, and that one born to his fortune should make a worse business of his life than was necessary, seemed really pitiable. Having protested against the marriage, Lush had a second sight for its evil consequences. Grandcourt had been taking the pains to write letters and give orders himself instead of employing Lush, and appeared to be ignoring his usefulness, even choosing, against the habit of years, to breakfast alone in his dressing room. But a tete-a-tete was not to be avoided in a house empty of guests, and Lush hastened to use an opportunity of saying it was one day after dinner, for there were difficulties in Grandcourt's dining at Effenden, and when is the marriage to take place? Grandcourt, who drank little wine, had left the table and was lounging, while he smoked, in an easy chair near the hearth, where a fire of oak boughs was gaping to its glowing depths, and edging them with a delicate tint of ashes delightful to behold. The chair of red-brown velvet brocade was a becoming background for his pale-tinted, well-cut features and exquisite long hands. Omitting the cigar, you might have imagined him a portrait by Moroni, who would have rendered wonderfully the impenetrable gaze and air of distinction. And a portrait by that great master would have been quite as lively a companion as Grandcourt was disposed to be. But he answered without unusual delay. "On the 10th. I suppose you intend to remain here. We shall go to Rylands for a little while, but we shall return here for the sake of the hunting." After this word there was the languid inarticulate sound frequent with Grandcourt, when he meant to continue speaking, and Lush waited for something more. Nothing came, and he was going to put another question, when the inarticulate sound began again, and introduced the mildly uttered suggestion, "You had better make some new arrangement for yourself." "What?" I am to cut and run, said Lush, prepared to be good-tempered on the occasion. Something of that kind. The bride objects to me. I hope she will make up to you for the want of my services. I can't help your being so damnably disagreeable to women, said Grandcourt, in soothing apology. To one woman, if you please. It makes no difference, since she is the one in question. I suppose I am not to be turned adrift after 15 years without some provision. You must have saved something out of me. Deuced little. I have often saved something for you. You can have 300 a year. But you must live in town, and be ready to look after things when I want you. I shall be rather hard up. If you are not going to be at Rylands this winter, I might run down there, and let you know how Swinton goes on. If you like. I don't care a toss where you are, so that you keep out of sight. Much obliged, said Lush, able to take the affair more easily than he had expected. He was supported by the secret belief that he should by and by be wanted as much as ever. Perhaps you will not object to packing up as soon as possible, said Grandcourt. The Torringtons are coming, and Miss Harleth will be riding over here. With all my heart. Can't I be of use in going to Gadsmere? No. I am going myself. About your being rather hard up. Have you thought of that plan? Just leave me alone, will you? Said Grandcourt, in his lowest audible tone, tossing his cigar into the fire, and rising to walk away. He spent the evening in the solitude of the smaller drawing room, whose, with various new publications on the table of the kind a gentleman may like to have on hand without touching, he employed himself as a philosopher might have done, in sitting meditatively on the sofa and abstaining from literature political, comic, cynical, or romantic. In this way hours may pass surprisingly soon, without the arduous invisible chase of philosophy, not from love of thought, but from hatred of effort from a state of the inward world, something like premature age, where the need for action lapses into a mere image of what has been, is, and may or might be, where impulse is born, and dies in a phantasmal world, pausing in rejection of even a shadowy fulfillment. That is a condition which often comes with whitening hair, and sometimes too, an intense obstinacy and tenacity of rule, like the main trunk of an exorbitant egoism, conspicuous in proportion as the varied susceptibilities of younger years are stripped away. But Grandcourt's hair, though he had not much of it, was of a fine, sunny blonde, and his moods were not entirely, to be explained as ebbing energy. We mortals have a strange spiritual chemistry going on within us, so that a lazy stagnation, or even a cottony milkiness may be preparing one knows, not what biting or explosive material. The navvy waking from sleep, and without malice heaving a stone, to crush the life out of his still sleeping comrade, is understood to lack the trained motive which makes a character fairly calculable in its actions. But by a roundabout course even a gentleman may make of himself a chancy personage, raising an uncertainty as to what he may do next, that sadly spoils companionship. Grandcourt's thoughts this evening were like the circlets one sees in a dark pool, continually dying out and continually started again by some impulse from below the surface. The deeper central impulse came from the image of Gwendolyn. But the thoughts it stirred would be imperfectly illustrated by a reference to the amatory poets of all ages. It was characteristic that he got none of his satisfaction from the belief that Gwendolyn was in love with him, and that love had overcome the jealous resentment which had made her run away from him. On the contrary, he believed that this girl was rather exceptional in the fact that, in spite of his assiduous attention to her, she was not in love with him. And it seemed to him very likely that if it had not been for the sudden poverty which had come over her family, she would not have accepted him. From the very first there had been an exasperating fascination in the tricksiness with which he had not met his advances, but wheeled away from them. She had been brought to accept him in spite of everything, brought to kneel down like a horse under training for the arena, though she might have an objection to it all the while. On the whole, Grandcourt got more pleasure out of this notion than he could have done out of winning a girl of whom he was sure that as he had a strong inclination for him personally. And yet this pleasure in mastering reluctance flourished along with the habitual persuasion that no woman whom he favored could be quite indifferent to his personal influence. And it seemed to him not unlikely that by and by Gwendolyn might be more enamored of him than he of her. In any case, she would have to submit, and he enjoyed thinking of her as his future wife, whose pride and spirit were suited to command everyone but himself. He had no taste for a woman who was all tenderness to him, full of petitioning solicitude and willing obedience. He meant to be master of a woman who would have liked to master him, and who perhaps would have been capable of mastering another man. Lush, having failed in his attempted reminder to Grandcourt, thought it well to communicate with Sir Hugo, in whom, as a man having perhaps interest enough to command the bestowal of some place, where the work was light, gentlemanly, and not ill-paid, he was anxious to cultivate a sense of friendly obligation, not feeling at all secure against the future need of such a place. He wrote the following letter, and addressed it to Park Lane, whither he knew the family had returned from Lubron. "My dear Sir Hugo, since we came home the marriage has been absolutely decided on, and is to take place in less than 3 weeks. It is so far the worse for him that her mother has lately lost all her fortune, and he will have to find supplies. Grandcourt, I know, is feeling the want of cash, and unless some other plan is resorted to, he will be raising money in a foolish way. I am going to leave Diplo immediately, and I shall not be able to start the topic. What I should advise is that Mr. Deronda, who I know has your confidence, should propose to come and pay a short visit here. According to invitation, there are going to be other people in the house, and that you should put him fully in possession of your wishes and the possible extent of your offer. Then, that he should introduce the subject to Grandcourt so as not to imply that you suspect any particular want of money on his part, but only that there is a strong wish on yours. What I have formerly said to him has been in the way of a conjecture that you might be willing to give a good sum for his chance of Diplo. But if Mr. Deronda came armed with a definite offer, that would take another sort of hold. 10-1 he will not close for some time to come, but the proposal will have got a stronger lodgment in his mind, and though at present he has a great notion of the hunting here, I see a likelihood, under the circumstances, that he will get a distaste for the neighborhood, and there will be the notion of the money sticking by him without being urged. I would bet on your ultimate success. As I am not to be exiled to Siberia, but am to be within call, it is possible that, by and by, I may be of more service to you. But at present I can think of no medium so good as Mr. Deronda. Nothing puts Grandcourt in worse humor than having the lawyers thrust their paper under his nose uninvited. Trusting that your visit to Lubron has put you in excellent condition for the winter, I remain, my dear Sir Hugo, yours very faithfully, Thomas Cranmer Lush. Sir Hugo, having received this letter at breakfast, handed it to Deronda, who, though he had chambers in town, was somehow hardly ever in them, Sir Hugo not being contented without him. The chatty baronet would have liked a young companion, even if there had been no peculiar reasons for attachment between them. One with a fine, harmonious, unspoiled face fitted to keep up a cheerful view of posterity and inheritance generally, notwithstanding particular disappointments, and his affection for Deronda was not diminished by the deep lying, though not obtrusive, difference in their notions and tastes. Perhaps it was all the stronger, acting as the same sort of difference does between a man and a woman in giving a piquancy to the attachment which subsists in spite of it. Sir Hugo did not think unapprovingly of himself, but he looked at men and society from a liberal menagerie point of view, and he had a certain pride in Deronda's differing from him, which, if it had found voice, might have said, "Who see this fine young fellow not such as you see every day, is he? He belongs to me in a sort of way. I brought him up from a child, but he would not ticket him off easily. He has notions of his own, and he's as far as the poles asunder from what I was at his age." This state of feeling was kept up by the mental balance in Deronda, who was moved by an affectionateness such as we are apt to call feminine, disposing him to yield in ordinary details, while he had a certain inflexibility of judgment, and independence of opinion, held to be rightfully masculine. When he had read the letter, he returned it without speaking, inwardly wincing under Lush's mode of attributing a neutral usefulness to him in the family affairs. "What do you say, Dan? It would be pleasant enough for you. You have not seen the place for a good many years now, and you might have a famous run with the Harriers if you went down next week," said Sir Hugo. "I should not go on that account," said Deronda, buttering his bread attentively. He had an objection to this transparent kind of persuasiveness, which all intelligent animals are seen to treat with indifference. If he went to Diplow, he should be doing something disagreeable to oblige Sir Hugo. "I think Lush's notion is a good one, and it would be a pity to lose the occasion. That is a different matter, if you think my going of importance to your object," said Deronda, still with that aloofness of manner which implied some suppression. He knew that the baronet had set his heart on the affair. "Why, you will see the fair gambler, the Lubran Diana, I shouldn't wonder," said Sir Hugo, gaily. "We shall have to invite her to the Abbey, when they are married," he added, turning to Lady Malinger, as if she too had read the letter. "I cannot conceive whom you mean," said Lady Malinger, who in fact had not been listening, her mind having been taken up with her first sips of coffee, the objectionable cuff of her sleeve, and the necessity of carrying Teresa to the dentist. Innocent and partly laudable preoccupations, as the gentle ladies usually were. Should her appearance be inquired after, let it be said, that as he had reddish blonde hair, the hair of the period, a small Roman nose, rather prominent blue eyes and delicate eyelids, with a figure which her thinner friends called fat, her hands showing curves and dimples like a magnified baby's. "I mean that Grandcourt is going to marry the girl you saw at Lubran. Don't you remember her, the Miss Harleth who used to play at roulette? Dear me. Is that a good match for him?" "That depends on the sort of goodness he wants," said Sir Hugo, smiling. "However, she and her friends have nothing, and she will bring him." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.